This is Michael Horn, December 1st, 2001, The Problem of Evil.
Sharon is also a very wonderful student. I'm surprised to see such a large audience here. I'm sort of wondering why you've come. Because you could be home right now. It's not rainy or cold, but it's the end of a long work week. And you've come to a talk about, of all things, evil, which is sort of strange. Boy. I'm shocked to see you here, really. on a more serious note, but apropos of this sort of more sort of frivolous comment here, lately we see almost nothing but reports of evil on the news. We're horrified, but despite our revulsion, we're also attracted. We watch the destruction of the Twin Towers again and again. We slow down on the freeway when there's a wreck and look with curiosity. We root for the outlaws in the movies. And what's the most popular Western in the last 20 years? Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. We root for the bad guys. Evil's got something vital and powerful about it that we all want a piece of. Now, evil's traditionally been thought of as a force like Darth Vader or a thing like Satan. In the last 100 years, new ideas on evil have emerged. Evil is now thought of as something human within all of us. It drives us to denigrate, exclude, and at the worst, obliterate our fellows. It comes into being when we develop ideas about how we must all be that excludes the point of view and lifestyle of others. Jung was very interested in the study of evil throughout his career. He came up with the idea of the shadow, the excluded part of ourselves. To get out of this mess we are in, he encourages us to make a relationship with the figures of the shadow, so that we can take some of their vitality while lessening their destructiveness. And here's a quote from Jung. Trying to define the shadow, he said in his collected works, "The shadow is a moral problem that challenges the whole ego personality. For no one can become conscious of the shadow without considerable moral effort. To become conscious of it involves recognizing the dark aspects of the personality as present and real. This act is the essential condition for any kind of self-knowledge, and it, therefore, as a rule, meets with considerable resistance. Closer examination of the dark characteristics, that is, the inferiorities constituting the shadow, reveals that they have an emotional nature, a kind of autonomy, and accordingly an obsessive, or better, a possessive quality." Now, I'm going to divide the talk up into three sections, and I thought we could have a brief break after the first section, and then a longer break after the second section, and then the final section. And what I want to do is have you ask questions at the end of each section, because the sections are sort of hopefully somewhat self-contained. And then we can sort of deal with what you're struggling with at the time and come back to it at the very end. Now, the first thing I want to talk about is what is evil. And I just want to run through the sort of parts of speech or... I'm not very good on grammar. What do we call a noun? Forgotten. Sixth grade. That's a thing, all right. There we go. Evil as a noun. Religious cosmologies take a mythological view of evil as something that exists, as a matter or a force. For example, a devil as the incarnation of evil, or a force of evil, or matter as being evil. If you're familiar with the Gnostic view, matter is actually evil and soul is good. But evil as a noun speaks of evil as something concrete, as something actually existing, as something substantial. And of course, these views are still with us. All the views that I'm going to run through here about evil are still present. We're still struggling with all of them. And traditional philosophy, beginning with the Greeks, takes the view that the essence or being of all things can be reduced to an origin, which explains it. In the case of evil as a noun, Plato, right way back in the beginning, defines evil as the opposite of the form of the good. Now, if you're not familiar with Plato, of probably not everyone is, but Plato's really the bad guy in all this, making things go back to origins and trying to find grounds or substantial explanations of things. Just the simple idea of a form, a triangle, for example, is always different when you draw it on the chalkboard. Plato's idea is that there's an ideal triangle that exists. And it exists in a metaphysical space, but it still exists. And then he extended this idea to concepts about human characteristics. And the ultimate characteristic for Plato was the good, and there was actually a form of the good. And this was Plato's idea of the philosophical way of conceptualizing God. So evil was the opposite of the form of the good. So evil, in some senses, way back there, had some type of substantial nature, right at the very beginning of philosophy. Now, evil is an adjective. We move along a little bit once we get to evil as an adjective. And there's some decline after Plato in metaphysical notions of what is good. But philosophers and theologians still come up with ideal concepts or ideal notions of what is a good thing or a good act. Aristotle's one example. He has this idea of the golden mean, which is sort of the mixture between, or the median rather, between excess and deficiency of something. You can either be rash or timid. And somewhere in the middle is what he would call courage, which is a median quality. So again, it's an ideal. It's an ideal of something that is. And so there's an ideal then of evil. Philosophers will speculate and say, try to define what evil is. Kant's a good one here. Kant had the idea of what he called the categorical imperative, and it was sort of based on biblical ideas, but it was basically do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so evil was again the opposite of that. So here again we're getting evil as something that we can not put our hands around here, but at least put our minds around. So it's something that exists as something absolute in contrast to good. So it's the same thing that Plato's doing, but in a more speculative form. Now, evil as an adverb, we're getting somewhere here, in my view. And in 19th and 20th century philosophy and theology, evil's no longer completely defined as the opposite of good. It's now becomes the modifier of an action. An action can now be seen as more or less evil. And acts and things can now be defined in a meaningful context rather than in an absolute way. And they don't get referred back to something substantial or something absolute. And Nietzsche's the beginning of this. Well, not the beginning, but Nietzsche's one of the big... what's the right word? Nietzsche said that he philosophized with a hammer. So he's one of the smashers of this concept that we can find the absolute definition of things, which is important, you'll see, in how I'm going to formulate evil for you. Nietzsche said we could go beyond good and evil, and he didn't mean that we could be amoral. He was a very moral person, really, in his personal life. What he was trying to get at was that good and evil, concepts of good and evil, were just that. They were concepts and constructions. And he wrote a book called The Genealogy of Morals, which is the sort of tracing back moral concepts to their origins. Some of his ideas about what the origins were, we might disagree with, but his process was to say that we can deconstruct these things and that they're not absolutes or fixed, that they're part and parcel of the context, social context and cultural context. Now, that's all very well, and that sort of can lead you into relativism or even nihilism, because Nietzsche's been accused of being nihilistic. So we really need something a bit more substantial if we're going to deal with this phenomena of evil. And I think where we really get somewhere is when we get into postmodernist philosophy. And I'm not going to take you on a great long discourse on postmodernist philosophy. I'm just going to contrast it to this idea of modernist philosophy, which is always looking for origins. We say that modernist philosophy begins with Descartes, but it really, in a sense, begins with Plato. Because it begins with the idea that we can trace something back, something is there to give us some security and say, this is good, this is evil, this is that. Now, what postmodernist philosophy does is look at processes rather than states, absolute states. And it begins with Nietzsche, because Nietzsche sort of begins to deconstruct all sorts of concepts and say, really, there's nothing static. And he wasn't specifically a process philosopher, but later on in the 19th century, the idea that we can only look at how things move from state to state in a meaningful way, because then we see context, we see the totality of states rather than absolutes. And we see processes dynamic and relative to context. And we see that there's no certain way of defining anything. There's only the meaningful context in which things emerge. And we're going to go into this in more depth. I can see you're all maybe attentive looks. I was hoping there weren't blank looks at this point. Okay. Now, just in this section, I'm going to talk about Michel Foucault. And I'm going to take you through his book, Madness and Civilization, to give you some idea of how a definition of evil might work in a postmodernist world. Foucault's sort of an enfant terrible of postmodernist philosophy, but he's an amazing person, really. He got into hot water with psychiatrists because he's one of the founders of anti-psychiatry, and you'll see that when I go through Madness and Civilization, if you haven't read the book. Has anyone read Madness and Civilization? Gordon, did you read that? No? Okay. Some of the psychiatrists might have got hold of it. He's a French philosopher. He's dead now. He was a gay man, and he died of AIDS in 1981, I think, just as the epidemic was getting going. And he's a incredibly erudite person. He doesn't really fit into any definition. He's a philosopher. He's a sociologist. He's a historian. He's a phenomenologist. He's just the most amazing person. I managed to go to a lecture of his at Stanford just before he died. It was sort of performance art. He's an amazing person. So it's just to make you pay attention to Foucault. Hopefully get you to pay attention to him. In his book, Madness and Civilization, it was actually his PhD thesis. And he was interested in studying irrationality. That was what he started out to do. And he thought that sort of the prototype of irrationality was the insane. And by the insane, he meant the psychotically insane. And he started his studies as a sort of historical sort of genealogy of the conceptualizations of the insane. And in the post-Renaissance period, the insane were looked upon as the irrational. As the Enlightenment began to get started, the insane were the irrational, and the discourse about the insane was that they were irrational, and they were actually put onto ships, which were called ships of fools, if you've ever heard of that expression, a ship of fools. And that's what the insane were, that's how the ship of fools got its name, and they were put on these ships and just sent out to sea, and they would sail across the seas. So they were excluded as irrational or foolish people. And then as the Enlightenment progressed into the 18th century, the insane were lumped in with the poor and with the criminals. And so the criminals and the insane and the poor were all locked up in the same sorts of places. And they were looked upon as the people who couldn't participate in the beginnings of capitalist mercantile society. These were all the ones that couldn't participate, the poor, the insane, and the criminals. And at the end of the 18th century, this is the famous, if you're any psychiatrist here, the great revolution in psychiatry, the doors of these places were thrown open and the insane were freed and separated out from the prisoners and the poor. And they were taken to places in the beautiful bucolic countryside, and they were then conceptualized as morally inferior, and moral treatment for the insane began. And they were, I had to read the Bible and, you know, learn the Ten Commandments or whatever. It was mainly in Christian countries that this was happening. This was seen as a great moment in freedom of the insane. But Foucault sees this again as another discourse about the insane to exclude them. They're morally inferior. And now we come to the present time, and this is rather controversial, so I don't see any other psychiatrists to ask me questions about this, but this is Foucault's point of view, and I think it's worth considering. What he thinks that we're currently doing is medicalizing the insane so that they're actually biologically inferior. They have chemical defects or neurophysiological defects or defects on their MRI scans or whatever. So now the insane are biologically deficient, and that's our current way of cutting off the insane from the rest of us. Now, what this led to, he got into a big struggle or a big discussion with Jacques Derrida, who's the other very famous postmodernist philosopher in France, who's still alive. Derrida's still alive. I also got to see Derrida. I came to Stanford. That was fun. Derrida's the pioneer of what's called deconstruction, which is a somewhat nihilistic postmodernist view that you can deconstruct any text about anything. It always has some referent that you can keep deconstructing. So it's like an infinite regress. You can just go and go and go and go. However, you know, that's not going to support Derrida tonight, but that's the sort of traditional view of what he's about with deconstruction. And he attacked Foucault sort of deconstructively, and this deconstructed Foucault's idea of separating out irrational and rational. Because a very strict postmodernist doesn't like any dichotomies like that. Dichotomies are constructed arbitrarily based on further deconstructions. There's always something underlying a dichotomy. So Foucault had to respond to that and realize that that was true. And that it wasn't about irrationality that the insane were being excluded. It was just forms of knowledge, forms of discourse, what he called forms of knowledge or forms of discourse about the insane that was actually excluding them. So he moved to a much more radical concept, which I want to use as the basis of my understanding of evil, was that any time we develop a discourse and then what we call reify that discourse, or say that discourse is actually true or existent in some way, we're always excluding something or, more horribly, somebody. So Foucault ended up with the idea that power is related to knowledge. That once knowledge gets formed and codified, it always contains the power to cut off and exclude. So in the case of the insane, the various discourses were really cutting off the insane at every point for all sorts of different reasons, but cutting them off and excluding them from the dominant group, the dominant society. And then he's extended this idea to pretty much everything you can consider. So he's become very much the basis of understanding diversity and the way that people get cut off in all sorts of circumstances. But philosophically, what's the most important point is that any time we begin to have a formed discourse, we're always going to cut something out or somebody out. Ask some questions on that in a minute. We're nearly there. Now, let's get on with that. Now, what this sort of led to was the idea of what was called meta-narratives, that people could construct enormous forms of knowledge and discourse which could massively exclude other people. And racist ideologies of these forms of meta-narratives. And ideas on sexual orientation as a current meta-narrative we're just struggling tremendously with. And then all sorts of things are meta-narratives, like Foucault and Derrida and the postmodernists are very opposed to Marxist ideas, even though their previous radical French colleagues were all sort of liberal Marxists. And they get into terrible trouble because they're not political. Because any type of ideology for a postmodernist in the Foucault tradition is a dangerous meta-narrative and can exclude other people or other groups. Now, the most pernicious examples that we've had in modern times about meta-narratives is probably fascism. Because what happens with meta-narratives is that they're one of the things that underlies them is the idea of purification or purity, that a narrative encompasses everything. So everything outside the narrative not only doesn't fit in, but it can be seen as impure. So I don't know whether you realize that the Nazis in Germany, they didn't start off with sending Jews to concentration camps. They started off with mentally retarded and chronically mentally ill. And then they actually moved on to the gypsies. Well, I think the gypsies might have been coincident. And they started their techniques of gassing people with the mentally ill. They'd back the trucks up to the asylums and put the mentally ill in the trucks and gas them. So that was the beginning. And then, of course, communists and socialists, and then finally was the Jews. But it was all the idea of purity, and that there was a pure, it was a meta-narrative about Germanic purity. And so things didn't just get excluded. They get excluded, and then they get obliterated. One more example here is African Americans and slavery. Now, slavery was a meta-narrative back in the 19th century. And there was exclusion and a certain amount of obliteration. There was obliteration of rights and obliteration of self-determination. But most horribly, what occurred here was obliteration of spirit. And in the Jewish case, there was somewhat of an obliteration of spirit, too. The obliteration of the ability to fight back and do anything about being excluded. So it has the most horrendous effects on autonomy and initiative. It silences life literally, and silences life in a psychological sense as well. Now, the other thing that occurs with exclusion that we're seeing right now is when the excluded group begins to fight back. And then we see the violent events that we're seeing right now. Because for tomorrow's workshop, I'm going to have you read an article from The New Yorker, and other people hopefully just the people from the workshop will pick it up for starters, but I've made quite a few copies, so other people can pick it up as well if you haven't seen it. It's an article in The New Yorker on suicide bombers in Palestine and the training of these young men and what they're like. It's basically what sort of people they are. And they're ready for revenge. You know, there's going to be more bombs go off. It's not going to stop. You know, once we read this article, it'll be a temporary stop, but it'll continue. Because their discourse right now is excluded. So my proposition about evil is that evil really is it's the process of exclusion, but it's bound up inside exclusion. Because it's both the exclusion and then it's the revenge that occurs after the exclusion. So it's all contained in the idea of purity, exclusion, certainty, all those things that I've mentioned, the way that we begin to understand evil. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to show you some slides of a trip that I went on with my family in Ireland, or to Ireland. And we went to Northern Ireland, and when you're going to Northern Ireland, you cross the border, and it just looks like Southern Ireland. You know, it's a very beautiful green country, and everyone talks the same, and you can get a pint of Guinness and all that. But what you notice when you come to the towns is that all these flags are up on the, you know, they're on the light poles and they're on the houses. And they're sort of British-looking flags, but they're red, white and blue, but, you know, you didn't quite know what it was. I thought it was some special occasion, that the special Irish holiday. But then you go to some towns and you see it, and other towns and you don't. And then when you get to Belfast, you don't see much of it in the main part of Belfast. Then when you go down the Shankill Road and the Falls Road, which I'm going to show you, the Shankill Road is the Protestant road, and the Falls Road is the Catholic road, which is right next to the Shankill Road. And it's in the poor part of Belfast. And these are basically the lower class poor people of Belfast living right next to each other, Catholics and Protestants. And then you figure out what the flags were. It's territorial. The flags in the little towns that you're coming to, they're mainly Protestants. You don't see the Catholics, because the Catholics are sort of ghettoized. These flags are the signifiers. This is our territory. Nobody pass into our territory unless you're one of us. So it becomes really quite frightening. When you first see it, you think, oh, it's some lovely celebration that's going on. But it's not. It's a marker of territory and saying, stay out. So I'm going to show you the slides, and it's sort of what I call a face of evil. It's evil in your face. It's rather a terrifying experience. Tourist buses don't go down the roads. You've got to get a taxi to go down there, a local taxi. And the taxi that we had, the taxi driver we had, this is a horrible part of it, really. He was part of both groups. He knew everybody. He knew the killers on both sides. So he could give us little vignettes of which killer killed who, and this killer killed this one. And there are horrible stories about this was where three bodies lay and stuff like that. So it's a very moving, painful, difficult experience, and evil right there in your face. Every block you go on. So could I have the lights off and get this machine working? Now there's the flag. Sorry, I'm going to have to. I'll squat down. Here we go. This is the flags on the Protestant houses. This is actually in Belfast on the Shankill Road. These are the housing settlements. And this is a big open area on the Protestant part of just back from the Shankill Road. You can see over there. There's one of the murals. You can see every block really has murals on the end of it, and we'll see them up close in a minute. That's as good as I can get it. This is the murals again. Well, on every single block there's a huge mural. See? Three, four of them. See? And getting a little closer. Portraits, lots of portraits. There we go. Now this was just the most horrible experience. See those two little kids there? They were walking down the street. We were sort of parked just right on the street that you can see a little bit of. And the kids were walking down the street, and one of them had what looked like an automatic pistol. And these were eight-year-old kids. And I wanted to photograph the girl, and she's got the pistol. The one on the right's got it. I think it was a toy, but it was tremendously realistic. And I didn't dare get out of the car. I wanted to get out of the car occasionally, but my family kept pulling me back in. And these are two sweet little girls, little sweet little Irish girls with this incredible weapon. And here's up close some of the pictures. The Protestant faction has two groups, the UFF and the UDA. And now that the IRA has a ceasefire going and have turned in their weapons, these two are fighting each other now. They've split the Shankill Road, and one group's up one end and one group's down the other, and they're actually fighting each other. That's the prison where some of the Protestants were in prison. And this is the thing that they do all the time. They have marches. When the Catholics are marching somewhere, then the Protestants will march. Well, the Protestants will do the big Orange Day parade, celebrating the Battle of the Boyne when King James was defeated in Ireland. They'll march through the Catholic areas. This is a mural picture of them doing their march. That's a Catholic church up the top. Here's another one of the prison. This is the most horrible one that I saw. I managed to get a close-up of this. This is one of the... These are all the martyrs on the Protestant side. These are young men that have been killed in battle, as it were. And this is what they think of Gerry Adams on the Protestant side, that he's just basically a toady of the... Well, terrified of the British. That's the big British lion. He's not really trying to establish dialogue or peace. Now, here's the wall between the Shankill Road and the Falls Road. This is about 30 feet high. There's another picture of the wall. Now these are the Catholic murals, and there's a different tone to the Catholic murals. Or really you should call them nationalist murals. because they call themselves nationalists and loyalists. The nationalists are the Catholics and the loyalists are the Protestants. This is Bobby Sands, who you might remember about 15 years ago died of a hunger strike in the British prison. And here's this is one of the Protestants. That should be in the Protestant group. This is the long memory thing. This is the, this is 1600, you see. This is the memory of exclusion. It goes back a long way. Now here's the Catholics again. These are some of the women martyrs on the Catholic side. Again, it's a sort of a softer, less in-your-face tone on the Catholic side. This is rather a horrible one, though, on the Catholic side. History is written by the winner. And here's, again, women in the original IRA. This goes back to fighting the British. So they've got very long memories, too. And here's one, another softer one on the Catholic side. These are bullets. These are children that are being killed, or bystanders that are being killed with police bullets. Rubber bullets. Bullet for everybody. This is on the Falls Road. All the people are being killed with rubber bullets. Okay. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there for a minute and take any questions on the sort of conceptualization of evil. That's what I'd call that section. Uh-huh. Well, that's a nice positive interpretation. Right. Yeah, I guess so. True. It could. That's right. That's true. Right. Any thoughts about the evil and the and exclusion? Any comments on that or questions? Or yeah. That's right.
So I'm not sure I know what you mean exactly by discourse there.
Well,
you don't mean just any conversation.
Well, Foucault almost takes it that far. Any conversation where there's certainty attached to it. And you'll see I'm going to bring that in. Yeah. Certain discourses. Discourse often is used in postmodernist philosophy just to cover anything that's certain. They assume that discourse, I think it's a more radical view of postmodernism, they assume that any discourse is going to have certainty attached to it. But it's really a certain type of discourse. And you'll see when we get to the psychology of evil that we're always discoursing within ourselves and cutting pieces out. So discourse, as soon as we start using words, you do start excluding things. We'll see that. That's a more radical view. But what he's really getting at is established type of discourse. You know, like the discourse that's gone on here since the 1500s. You know. Yeah.
In connection to that, you said you had two sentences about silence.
Mm-hmm.
It went by so fast. What I heard was silence, a connection between silence and freedom.
No, I don't think so. Did anyone else?
Do you remember saying anything about silence as opposed to discourse?
No.
I think you said exclusion, silence.
Oh, silencing.
Silencing.
Yeah, exclusion can cause silencing of spirit or silencing of life, and then on the other side, if it doesn't silence life, it can cause violent revenge and desire for destruction on the other side, like we see here. You know, the Catholics are the excluded. This is something we don't see here or we don't hear about. We never see this stuff on TV. You know, we were just shocked to see this up close. And the Catholics are really the disadvantaged group. And it's always portrayed that somehow the Catholics are the violent group. The Protestants are just really, it's amazing how violent they are. And the Catholics are violent in their own way, but the Catholics are the narrative really is excluding the Catholics. So the Catholics in their turn have become violent. They haven't been silenced at all. They've become extremely violent back. Yeah.
I did, a number of years ago, I did a lot of doorbelling for political candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I came to a door where they had an American flag,
mm-hmm.
usually the person wanted to argue with me,
mm-hmm.
whatever the position was. And I wonder, you know, your flags tend to tie into the notion of the meta level.
Right, meta narrative. That's right. I don't want to get into flags. I'm an Australian, and I'm a legal alien, and I'm a loyal legal alien. But the topic of flags is so inflammatory in the United States. I'll deal with that tomorrow in the silence and quiet of the workshop, because I think it's a very important topic. It's a very important topic. Go ahead. Well, the discourse includes the people who are creating the discourse.
Yeah,
like, we're the sane people, so we can create the discourse about the insane. We're the in-group, and they're the out-group. Is that what you meant?
If you participate in the discourse, then you're probably not excluded.
Oh, no, absolutely. The people who are excluded are the ones who don't participate in creating the discourse. Sometimes the discourse gets created for us. You know, we're all good Americans, but we have all sorts of discourses created for us and reinforced through the media and all the other channels of communication. So we sometimes get caught up in meta-narratives willy-nilly. You know, like, not all the Germans were wanting to kill off mentally ill people or gypsies. You know, so meta-narratives can take on a life of their own. That's the point Foucault makes. That's where the idea of evil sort of being infused in this idea of meta-narrative or rigid discourse. You can't sort of pin it down. It's part of this process, it's what we call an epistemological process, really, of trying to create knowledge, and then this type of knowledge then creates evil, or is imbued with evil by its very nature. And we'll be talking about how other forms of knowledge can help us get out of this. Yeah. Right.
I wonder if things declare themselves by their essence or by their context, or that being something that we have opposite, a pair of opposites. Could be both and neither.
Could you do that? I'm about to take off on archetypes, but is that what the point?
It sounded right. Like in your discussion that we sort of move beyond Platonic forms as being a
right, absolutely.
Way of approaching
right.
The process of people.
That's right.
But yeah, I'm wondering whether it can still be part of the picture.
Well, this is Jung is a good guy in my presentation, but Jung has a modernist view too, and I'm not a supporter of archetypes as a type of stable structure. That's his modernist idea. His shadow idea is incredibly postmodernist and amazingly, in my mind, very useful. So this is my personal view. So I wasn't going to set up his idea of archetypes as like Platonic forms or absolutes or whatever and criticize him for that. Because he had other ideas about evil other than the idea of the shadow. He had ideas that evil was part of the nature of God. That's answer to Job. And then his sort of early ideas really that there were archetypes of evil too, like in the unconscious, like humans actually had embedded an archetypal evil in the unconscious. But I'm going to use this shadow idea because that's very, very postmodernist and I think a very liberating non-essentialist part of Jung that really helps us. This is my personal point of view. Again, I'll be open to discussion on this one. That's coming. That's all coming. Right. This is just to get the idea of exclusion and meta-narratives and knowledge and all those sorts of things. What's the time here? Okay, any more questions? All right, I'm going to quickly go through the next section and then we'll have a break, and break for coffee. Now what this next section's about is sort of the history of how we got here, and I'm not going to go into too much detail of this, but just to give you an idea of how we got to this point, just a bit of follow-up of things like archetypes and those sorts of things. Because a lot of these ideas are still with us, embedded in our culture. these concepts. Now, if we go right back to cosmogony, which is theories about the origin of the universe, we hear all sorts of things about exclusion right off the bat. We hear chaos going to cosmos. Now, I don't know if any of you know that cosmos means order and chaos means disorder. So a lot of primitive cosmogonies are creating order out of disorder. Now, already that's a narrative that's or a form of knowledge or discourse that's including disorder, you see. And in contemporary psychoanalysis, we're interested in disorder. Disorder is a very fascinating thing for us. Chaos is interesting. In the Christian cosmogony, nothingness to existence. And again, that's problematic because we're actually interested in nothingness. Nothingness has got all sorts of fascinating things that we can find in nothingness that's going to emerge for us. And the other thing is dark to light. Let there be light. The darkness comprehended it not. And darkness, again, is something that we're going to be very interested in, as you'll see as we go along. So right off the bat, you know, the first people that tried to figure out what the universe was all about were creating meta-narratives that were excluding things like irrationality that we're doing with the insane, like Foucault points out, chaos, nothingness, and darkness. So again, there's this idea of purity or order. They were really interested in order, but when we get into purity later on, when we get into primitive religions and their ideas about defilement, and we still have ideas of defilement. Now, when I was a kid, I don't know if this is the same for Catholics now, Catholics could only eat fish on Fridays, and Muslims couldn't eat pork. And if any of you have been to India, you know there's cows wandering around the streets. The Hindus won't eat beef. And the strict Jewish people don't eat meat containing blood. It's kosher meat. But there's all sorts of rites of purification. Baptism really is a rite of purification. So this idea of defilement, sort of primitive idea of defilement, and then purification is still a big part of how we think about evil. And obsessive-compulsive disorder, any of the therapists in the room, you know, that's all about contamination and purification. You know, hand-washing is just the most basic symptom. OCD patients will say, I'm contaminated, doctor. And, you know, it's usually something modern like bugs or viruses, but sometimes when it's on a very primitive level, it's just, doctor, I'm contaminated, and I've got to wash my hands for 5 hours to get them clean. So the idea of purity is a big part of this that we still hear about. And we have renewal myths to repurify ourselves. And repurifying ourselves is almost all myths of repurification get us back to origins. We go back to the original cosmological event and then we purify ourselves. And what's our most common purification ritual in American society? It's about to occur. No one knows? New Year's. New Year's. It's a purification ritual. Okay. Now we go into a little bit more complicated religious ideas, and we have the Gnostic ideas of matter as being impure and soul as being pure. And this gets into Christianity too, because Gnosticism and Christianity got all mixed up. And in the Gnostic view, the soul is imprisoned in matter, and the task is to get gnosis or knowledge to release the soul from matter. And the Christian concept of flesh and spirit, of course, the same sort of thing. In a more complicated form, as the Christians kicked the Gnostics out, but basically a Gnostic idea. But again, it's an impurity idea that matter is actually impure. Our bodies are impure. And in a Gnostic idea, actual matter is impure. And the next thing we get onto is sin as a way of looking at evil. And sin is about transgression of edicts. So somebody has got to establish the edict. And always we think, here, the God established the edict. But of course, you know, if we're Nietzscheans and we trace all this back, we see various human societies establishing edicts. So quite a obvious form of meta-narrative of knowledge getting going about what's right and wrong. And then what happens to sinners, you know, when they sin. And some of the pernicious things we get into here with sin, which we still struggle with, is control of appetites. Appetites, sexual appetites and other forms of appetites. You know, in the Ten Commandments, it's all about sin and gluttony and da-da-da-da-da. You know, I can't remember them all, but they're all about human appetites. So the exclusion of human appetites is a very important part of all these edicts that come down in these early stages where religions are established. Of course, then we get into envy and greed. You know, once appetites are excluded, the nasty little shadow figures, appetitive shadow figures, become envious and greedy. And here we have anorexia and bulimia. You know, just a classic example of that. The bulimic person breaks out and is like a locust and goes through the kitchen and eats everything, and then vomits. It feels sinful and transgressive and vomits, and then goes into a period of anorexia where appetites are restrained. If you've read the book Holy Anorexia, you know, the thesis of the book is a large number of female saints were actually anorexics, and their ascetic lifestyle was control of their appetites, which was part of the Christian religion, or Christian transgression edicts of the Middle Ages. So again, here we're getting into revenge. You see, envy is revenge and greed is revenge on a personal basis. So these things aren't just social, as we'll see in the final section. They're very personal and embedded in ourselves. We even get into things about divine and human nature as religion becomes more speculative, that human nature is somehow sinful, original sin, which we hear about, which gets going fairly early on with St. Paul and then Augustine, and picked up in the Middle Ages and in the Reformation. And the other thing is that humans are vain and finite and weak, and humans are just a rotten lot. and gods are wonderful. So we have another types of meta-narratives where humans are excluded from the clockwork universe, and then moving into relativity theory, which is a completely different paradigm, and then quickly moving to quantum theory, which was a different paradigm. And poor old Einstein was in terrible trouble. He didn't like quantum theory. He said God won't play dice with the universe, because quantum theory was even more disturbing and uncertain than relativity theory. We really haven't got into the full feeling of quantum theory, because quantum theory is radically uncertain, and it still hasn't actually penetrated into the general culture, I don't think. And the Romantic movement, you know, was always seen as a breakthrough, you know, for feeling. But then feeling got privileged over thought. So we had another narrative that thought gets excluded by Romantic philosophy. So again, it's still another exclusion. Now, the postmodernist world, like I said, gets into the idea of process. And Heidegger is the sort of most famous person in this school. And I'm not going to go into a great long Heidegger thing. I'm just going to try and get you into the idea of an essence of being as being itself. Being here, what Heidegger called being there or being here, was the essence of what we were. And what he meant by being here is that we were actually thrown here. We've arrived here from we know not where. The metaphor I like to get, or the image I like to get, is that we came down a laundry chute and we landed in the basement. Here we were. There was a few other being there's around us, but where did we come from? And then, where are we going to? We end to die. Where do we go next? So, the key thing for Heidegger was what he called the facticity of being there. Just being there. And then he developed a whole lot of modes of thinking about being there, which I'm not going to go into. What I want to get you thinking about, or being with, because it's a scary notion. When you first study Heidegger, you know, it's hard to go home in the down the freeway in San Francisco. I was studying it up in the city. Oh, I'm just being here. That's it. You know, so it's quite a thing to get your mind around, but it's very liberating once you do, because then you have to struggle with what is the nature of being here, and it's an essential element, really, of the good parts of Jungian psychology, the shadow aspect. The thing that Heidegger got into trouble with, though, and again, here we get into the troublesome parts of Jung, was the idea of authentic being. He thought that you could somehow bootstrap yourself up into an idea of authentic being. If you could face death, you could become an authentic person by separating from all your fallows. He said separating from the they, not being part of the herd, and becoming an individual, which was authentic, an authentic human. This is a huge problem for Heidegger. And Jung's idea of individuation can be sometimes seen this way too. And some Jungians will even speak about it this way. He talked about the collective. I hate when I hear the word collective. That's a terrible word, because what we're wanting to get into is, the last section is, Our connection to the collective is what is important, based on the idea of exclusion that we heard about Foucault talking about. And I've mentioned some of the other problems, the modernist problems in Jung's theory, that God is evil and good, and the archetypes of evil in the unconscious. But individuation, when I first started as a psychiatry resident, was a great thing. You know, it was the 70s, and we were all going off to encounter groups. Esalen was just nearby, you know. Only a four-hour drive down to Esalen for a weekend in the hot tubs. And we were all individuating, and we were reading Carl Maslow and Carl Rogers and all that stuff. And, you know, we were all going off on our own narcissistic little trips, really. We thought we were including everybody else. You know, we'd all sit around and have group hugs, but we were on the sly, we were stealing other people's girlfriends and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, it wasn't really, it was a very self-centered form of development, which is, in some ways, it seems like it's difficult. You're so trapped in the they that it's actually liberating, and you feel like you've liberated yourself when you start to get into this mode of being. But it's actually much more difficult to actually relate authentically to the they, the others, and we'll talk about that in the last section. So that's just a quick run through of all the philosophical traps and some of the problems that people have got into, and some of the theories which look good, like individuation looks good, or Heidegger really is the father of existentialism, and that looked good. You know, define your own life, become your own person, all that sort of stuff looks good. But it's always in isolation from others. It's always somehow or other a cutting off or an excluding, a narrative about exclusion. So that's the end of that section. Any questions before we have a break? Yeah.
So you say that you feel like this exclusionary process is always evil?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So rather a radical assertion. I'm sticking by it. Right. Right. But we always have to make assertions. We're always going to be making assertions. We can't not make assertions. By the very nature of thought, thought's cutting off experience because exactly. So it's always, we're always in this paradox. That's what's so fascinating about it. Virginia?
I was going to say evil as a noun, an adjective, or an adverb.
Yeah. Repent?
Evil as a noun, an adjective, or an adverb. Your answer to him was that, yes, this, that it's exclusionary.
Right. Is it a noun?
The evil that you describe, is it a noun?
Well, it's very difficult to formulate. You know, I just wanted to go through the noun, adverb, and adjective just to see how we do that. But it's like it's embedded in this process of exclusion because the narrative takes on its own life, like I said before. It becomes an evil narrative. And any meta-narrative is by its nature evil because it's exclusionary. That's the claim I'm making. So it's not like it's a noun because you can't say a narrative is a noun. And yet it's not a person, it's not an adjective or an adverb. It's really a word that we got to somehow exclude. But I'm trying to get to some more ontological or beingness of what it might be that it's going to help us deal with it in meaningful ways. Okay? Does that answer the question? Probably not.
No.
Is everybody okay with that idea that's embedded in the process of creating a narrative which excludes? That's the basic definition.
Yes.
Okay? Yeah.
What about the notion that some feminist theologians hold that God is community?
Right, well,
which is anti-exclusionist by its very nature.
That's right. That's right. Right. We'll have another idea of God in a minute, too. That's even, what's more direct. It sort of gets at that. Yeah.
Most young people today, they'll allow their friends to have their own thoughts and choices.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they acknowledge the fact that they have to organize, you know, their
Sure.
That's different than our generation.
Sure. No, that's fine if we organize ourselves and go off and do something. But if we organize something that by its very discussion says you can't participate, like if you're a girl, you can't play boys' games or something like that, you know. But it's no problem really with forming groups and going off and doing things. It's creating a narrative that forms the group that then excludes other people, and that's so common with how we create groups. You know, just our professional groups, you know, the way we organize our professional groups, you know. Especially with our therapy professional groups, because we all do the same thing, you know, basically. We sit around in different groups. That's right. If you create a narrative that...
And these young people don't put a value.
No. Well,
somebody has a really different set of...
things they want to do. Sure.
Now
that's terrific. If we can do more of that, that's what we want. Yeah. Any more questions for now? So this will be break time. How long? 10 minutes? 15?
John, how long is break?
15.
Okay. Me okay at the back? Still working okay? Well, not too many people have gone home. That's good. It's always encouraging. Some of the questions on exclusion, I think people were questioning my more extreme view of exclusion. And I'm sort of sticking with the extreme view, not to be extreme, but to try to just stick with Foucault's fundamental idea that as soon as we create any type of understanding about something, even if we decide to have a little group where we go and do something that it's okay with everybody else, it's still exclusionary. And by the very nature of forming thought itself, it's excluding experience that we're having. And part of contemporary psychoanalysis actually is staying in touch with experience, especially the analyst experience, which is so difficult to do, of the immersion experience that the analyst has with the patient, and then trying to help the patient begin to go into that experience without creating a narrative or a knowledge or a discourse. We're so quick to create a discourse. So it has an important point, but I'm not being extreme in saying that kids who go and start a photography club are somehow excluding others. But by the very nature of saying we're interested in photography and it's saying that others wouldn't be. It's just by implication. It has its purpose really in the terms of internal psychology, because we're always creating exclusions of parts of ourselves by the very nature of forming thought around our experience. So Foucault's making a very important point. And somebody asked me about meta-narratives, and meta means overarching narratives. And they're even called hegemonic, which means big control. Marxism, fascism, capitalism, Christianity, Jungian psychology, you know, all these are hegemonic meta-narratives because they develop a life of their own, like I was talking about. Like we're a capitalist society, you know, we never hear anything else, that's all we are. Capitalism has triumphed the whole world, and it's now called democracy, you see, that's another meta-narrative, you see. So again, it's changed, it's now a meta-narrative called democracy. It used to be brute capitalism in the 19th century, you know, it's sort of what it was. So just to give you, an importance of this particular concept, how useful it is, hopefully convincing you of that, or persuading you, not convincing you. Now, what I'm going to do now is call face-to-face with the other. And this is the more personal part of it, but I want to make the emphasis that the personal and the social are completely... not parallel, but intertwined and never separated. I'm going to deconstruct this whole idea of individuation from the collective or the they or the 70s hedonistic Eslam thing. Now, I just want to start you off again with a little bit of theology, and I'll get more deeply into theology in a minute. But Karl Barth's an important person in this beginning of this dialogue idea between the face of the face, me, and the face of the other. Because Karl Barth is a German theologian. He's a Swiss, actually. He lived in Germany most of his life. Lived through the First and Second World War. And at the end of the First World War, he was just really disturbed, or right through the First World War, because he lived in Germany all the way through, with the clergy's response, the Lutheran clergy's response to the First World War, the patriotism, that God was on the side of the Germans. And, of course, if he'd lived in Britain, the Anglicans were all, God was on the side of the British too. What he wanted to do was reestablish God in dialogue with humans. But there wasn't a stable God out there. And he referenced back to the Bible, the Old Testament. He developed the idea of the covenantal God, which is a God which spoke through the prophets or in the burning bush or with the Ten Commandments, whatever. God actually came down and there was a dialogue between God and humans that went backwards and forwards. And Barth sort of made this a process concept of God, where God and humans were always in dialogue, and there was always a struggle to understand God and God to understand humans. And this was a transcendent God that was revealed in God's acts through humans. It was a very important beginning of a face-to-face with the divine, which you'll see in a minute becomes literally that, a face-to-face. And Barth was the first Lutheran minister to really face up to Hitler. There was a big Lutheran Congress, I think 1931 or 32, I can't remember, just after Hitler had got into power. And Barth actually nailed some thesis, like Luther, to the door, saying what the Christian response to fascism was. And of course, about a week later, he was deported to Switzerland. And he spent the whole war in Switzerland, or the whole 30s in Switzerland, but pamphleteering, he was a huge influence on the Lutheran resistance to Hitler. Of course, he'd be dead if he'd stayed much longer than, like, Bonhoeffer was another person. He was hanged by Hitler. And the amazing thing about Barth was right after the war, the armistice had just been declared, Barth took himself back to the University of Bonn, I think it was, and was bombed out, of course, started theology classes the first winter after the armistice was signed, with German students in theology. And his lectures, I've got his lectures of that winter classes. It's just really a moving thing. So it gets us now into not just the face-to-face with God, but the face-to-face with the other. And now we've got to move to some of the Jewish thinkers here. And of course, to try to get a new way of conceptualizing evil was pretty difficult for Jewish theologians. But Martin Buber really started this off, though, in the 20s with his concept of I-Thou, if anyone's familiar with that wonderful book. What the Thou meant was that when one came into relationship with another, one could relate to the other as it or Thou. And Thou was allowing the other's presence to emerge, so it was putting oneself aside and allowing the presence of the person to become or be. So here you're going to hear about ontology again. This is the being of the other, allowing the being of the other to manifest to oneself, which was putting oneself aside. See, not individuating and being out there. It was actually putting oneself aside for the presence of the other to emerge. And he also had this notion in terms of objects. So it was a way of presencing the world, presencing nature. And of course, presencing God. Because God, in the Buber world, was both a transcendent God, but it also was a God that appeared in the Thou, when the Thou appeared in its full presence to us, to the individual. Now, Immanuel Levinas is actually a postmodernist, and he's Jewish, he's secular, and he's French. He has all these things. And he's really, it's an amazing philosophy. It's hard to read. I wish he'd written an easy book, but it's Levinas, L-E-V-I-N-A-S, Immanuel Levinas. And he's ontological because he changes Heidegger's whole idea of being there, which is just us, me being there, to the idea of being with. That any time we're being there, we're taking up the place of the other. So my staying in there, I'm excluding someone by taking that other person's place. And here we're hearing exclusion. So in Levinas's philosophy, an ontology or a being of ourselves begins with an ethics of giving away our place to the other. And he talks about the face of the other invoking us to give ourselves away to the other. So it's a with the other, it's a with the collective, and it gives us a basic ethics, you see, which is precedes our being. If we're giving away, we're being tolerant and patient and open to the other as the unfolding of being, if you get all that. And ask me questions in a minute. But he's both being philosophical and he's challenging Heidegger explicitly, which he does, and he's developing Buber's idea into an ethics. And he's placing God in the face of the other. God is in the vulnerable face of the other when the other is present. So he's doing away with a transcendent God. So the dialogue with God is the dialogue with taking in the other, which is the other's point of view. So it's getting to resolution of this exclusionary idea that Foucault is talking about. So it's a sort of a postmodernist ethics. So it gets us away from radical deconstruction into an ethics of the other and the giving away and the taking in of the other. Now, here we go with Jung, because the shadow is a wonderful idea. The shadow is the other within. The shadow is the cut off, disavowed, bastardized, excluded, crushed, obliterated, eviscerated aspects of ourselves. And the shadow figures all appear in these guises. They appear as criminals and murderers and perverts and mutilated people and you name it. Arab terrorists, whatever you like, appears as a shadow. Now, currently, who's the shadow for the United States? Look, the bullseye, can you see that? What could be more wicked than the shadow? Okay. Who's the shadow for the Muslim terrorists? Here we are, the shadow. Look at this beautiful shadow. Perfect, you know. Dog. Two dogs. Smiling. No bullseyes on that. So one person's shadow is another. One person's evil is another person's good, etc., etc. I think I've made that point many times. But the shadow is what we can't tolerate about ourselves. It's just cut off. And wonderful thing about Jung's concept is the shadow, the figures that appear in the shadow, the dream figures. Like tomorrow we'll do a little bit with dreams. And the dream figures are all wicked creatures. But Jung's whole idea about dreams and about the shadow, especially dreams, was that all the figures of the dreams are parts of us. So when you start interpreting dreams, either for yourself or when you're doing it as a therapist, it's a horrifying concept. It's even horrifying for me after 13 years of analysis when I have a dream with a horrifying figure, because analysis doesn't cure the shadow. The shadow is always coming up to challenge one. That's the whole point of this continuous process. So the shadow was just absolutely wonderful idea. Jung spoiled it because he sort of reified things like archetypes and animas and animuses and we blah 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 about them. It's much better to talk about criminals in the shadow and bin Laden in the shadow or George Bush in bin Laden's dreams in the shadow. Right, that's where he'd appear. George is running around in all the Palestinian bombers' shadows at nighttime. So shadow figures is what I want to get you interested in. And now in analysis or in any process of personal development, again, it's a giving away of the ego. The ego is a big being there. Our dream egos, if you think about your dreams, your dream ego is just front and center, you know, not giving up, fighting to stay put. So the most important aspect of analysis is the giving up of the ego's hegemony, control, the ego's meta-narrative about what's what about oneself, you see. The ego is our media, who's spreading all this stuff about the greatness of the United States and the terribleness of the bombers or whatever. So the ego is the person who's creating the internal narrative of exclusion of the figures of the shadow. Now, once the ego can begin to give up its hegemony or control, it gives a chance for God to emerge. And Jung's idea of the transcendent function, which I gave a talk on here before, is a wonderful idea, but I think it just gets us too ethereal. It's too ethereal. Because I think, again, God appears in the face of the shadow figures, of our own shadow figures. That's where I want to get into the idea of nothingness and emptiness and chaos and all the disastrous things that appear. Deserts that appear in our dreams, black holes, windstorms, you know, typhoons, all those sorts of things. They're the interesting aspects of the dream, because that's the other, the radical other that has the God inside it. So I'm posing another radical idea for you to consider. The transcendent function is it's too ethereal clinically. It's really in my clinical experience, in my own personal experience, it's the confrontation with these other elements that's the vital thing. And then getting us back to Levinas, this idea of the other. Let's see. Now, the other thing I think is problematic about Jung's psychology goes on to the idea of integration. And Levinas is very big on the idea of living with the other rather than integrating the other. So he's very against sort of declarations of human rights and things like that, because that becomes a meta-narrative. Because even declarations of human rights, which look good, are going to somehow exclude something. So he's into a very radical form of being with, which is continuously struggling with the other in an ongoing way. Like not a melting pot where we're all melting together, but a place where we're all continuously in this struggle with the shadow without and the shadow within. That's why I was referring to my own shadow figures. You know, I'm still having nasty dreams at night. The other idea is that God is radical knowledge in the face of the other, or in the face of the shadow figure. It's something that we can't deal with, we can't face, our ego can't tolerate, externally or internally. So it's nothing pretty, or it's nothing nice. It doesn't come in tablets, or you don't dig it up in the sand in the desert or whatever. And then God, the other way of looking at God is deconstructor. You know, God is deconstructing the ego's view all the time. So here we get into a way of looking at deconstruction, which I think is useful. That God just breaks in once we take account of the shadow figures. And sort of like the hammer, philosophizing with the hammer, like Nietzsche was talking about. I work at part-time at Harborview. I do my teaching up at Harborview, and my office is in Pioneer Square. And I take the bus up from the... I leave my car up at Harborview, so I live on Vashon, and I take the ferry, and then I take the bus up to Harborview. Has anybody ever taken the number 3 or 4 bus? Ah, Ray! That's great! Can anyone describe what the clientele of the number 3, 4 bus is like? Right? Absolutely, right? Different races. Mentally ill.
Yeah,
physically disadvantaged.
Yeah.
Single mothers.
I don't know.
Proselytizing for various religions and political causes at the top of their voice. Yelling. Fighting with each other. Yelling at the bus driver. You name it, you know. The number 3 bus is a fantastic place to meet the face of the other. Right. And here's a prejudice for me. I got on at Harborview after my class with the residents, and I was sort of tired because the residents always get at me. You know, they question every single thing I say, and I'm exhausted by the time I'm finished. And so I got on the bus, and there was this manic woman on the bus going a million miles an hour. And I thought, oh, she's come from the treatment center, and she's not taking a medication. You know, I was doing all the Foucault things and biologizing her. And she was just talk, and she just wouldn't stop. And she had a violin with her. And as we turned around the corner to come down James Street, she pulled out a violin, and I thought, oh, no! She's going to play some terrible music. It's going to be awful. And she started, and she started to play the most beautiful classical music. And all down the James Street, we all got silently listening to this beautiful music. And then when she got to her stop, she rolled it up and talk, 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 talk. And off the bus. So I had a lesson in taking in the other. And now just to summarize, I hope you can see that we do, I think, have a way out of the dilemma of evil, and it's just a very, very challenging way out. It's really taking in this radical other. And at this present time that we're in now, it's taking in the radical other of the Palestinians and the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the various other others that we're actually fighting with. And I've got an article here, I told you before, a wonderful article from the New Yorker on the Palestinian bombers, the ones that some of probably let off the bomb last weekend, bombs last weekend. And I'd like the workshop people to read it so we can sort of dream about it overnight and begin to talk about it tomorrow, because it's very hard to take in. I found it just really difficult to take in the article. It's just wonderful. The New Yorker's doing a great job, by the way. There's lots of these articles in the New Yorker. There's more copies there than probably workshop participants, but if workshop participants had taken first and then others afterwards. So what we're trying to do here is get ourselves to the idea of exclusion, and then we're trying to get into an ethics or morality. And the key thing about this morality is tolerance, and I'm not talking about airy-fairy sort of sugar-coated tolerance. Tolerance is about the hardest thing you can imagine. The number 3 bus is really a great place to begin to get into tolerance. But tolerance of taking in the point of view of these young men who are being trained, you know, turning up in droves to be trained as suicide bombers, is just immensely difficult. The other thing is patience, because it just takes a long time to take things in. You think you just can't do it, and this is something I'm not going to be able to do. It just takes a really long time. And it takes a real steadiness, too, and a tremendous amount of faith. This is where faith, I think, comes in, and a dark sort of faith. Because right now, to sort of take in that the Arab bombers might have a point of view is just a really difficult thing to do at this moment in time. So it's trying to define a process ethics that Levinas is getting at, and what Jungian concept of the shadow helps us get at. I'd like to finish up with a quote from Jung. It's from Good and Evil in Analytical Psychology. It's Collected Works, Volume 10. And he says, where do we get this belief, this apparent certainty, that we know what is good and what is bad? Ye shall be gods, knowing good and evil. That's in a quote. Only the gods know, not us. This is profoundly true in psychology. If you take this attitude, or the attitude, this thing must be very bad, but on the other hand it may not. Then you have a chance of doing the right thing. If you already know in advance that you are behaving as if you were a god, if you already know in advance, then you are behaving as if you were a god. We are all only limited human beings, and we do not know in any fundamental sense what is good and bad in a given case. We know it only abstractly. To see through a concrete case to the bottom is God's affair alone. Thank you. So we've got 10 more minutes. Okay.
That was fascinating.
Well, thanks.
I would love you to comment on your statement that you are a Christian in light of someone like Bonhoeffer.
Mm-hmm.
And the question behind Bonhoeffer is the deep being with that he seemed to go through, but that led him to protest Hitler to the point of joining the plot to kill him.
Mm.
So,
right. Well, this is a huge problem, and you can't criticize Bonhoeffer from this point, my place, you know, so I wouldn't want to do that. But with this ethic, you probably would criticize him in the abstract. And that's the most challenging part of this whole ethos or ethic, really, because it's a pacifist ethic in at its core. So,
as opposed to,
yeah. it's really a tremendously difficult ethic. And I'm not abiding by it. You know, I'm not privileging myself here or criticizing Bonhoeffer, but it is a pacifist ethic. At the ultimate, it's taking in Hitler or, you know, Saddam Hussein or Bin Laden.
Is it possible that to have this ethic from the point of view of consciousness, and I think either from a Christian perspective or a deep Buddhist sense of compassion, because everything is allowed to be in one's awareness and accepted,
uh-huh.
and yet be a pacifist and yet resist?
Not really, no. It's a pacific it's just in the moving aside of the Levinas idea of moving aside. And Levinas developed his philosophy after the Holocaust. That's what's so amazing about his philosophy in the 50s and 60s. The moving aside, or the giving up of one's place, you know, sort of a radical passivity, really.
And one last question, would you sense that Christ's suffering and dying on the cross would be an example of that?
Well, I don't want to sort of privilege Christianity too much, seeing I'm a Christian. But Christ has, there's lots of examples of Christ doing this. I'm not quite sure about the giving up of the crucifixion per se. It's a non-resisting, and in that sense. What's interesting about Christ is the Beatitudes, you know, taking in all the others in the Beatitudes. I think that's speaks to. I don't want to get into the crucifixion too much. I don't want to privilege Christianity too much. Okay.
I'm wondering now. Will you be talking tomorrow about Jung's answer to Job, where he
will
into the evil side of
yeah,
God?
Yeah, I will be.
That. Yeah.
Right. No, I'll be talking about that. Yeah. And various other struggles Jung had with evil and Jung's evil acts. I'll talk about some of those. Kent?
Where do boundaries fit in this?
Well, you know what? Can you elaborate on that before I launch into that?
I'm on number 3 bus. I don't know if they let people in danger space or teach you battery or drag you or anything like that.
Well, it's never happened. See, it's sort of it's always a work in progress, the number 3 bus. I'm sure someone will strike me eventually, but I'm there long enough. So I'll have to see. I might strike them back, I'll see. But again, it would be a radically giving away, it's sort of turning the other cheek ethos. But it's really a psychological thing, like all these difficult examples, you know, there's just so many mundane examples of taking things in. It's just constantly problematic, really, once you start to observe things in this way. Go ahead at the back.
Well, I don't quite follow the connection from this taking in of the other that is necessarily
pacifistic, because if one can take in the
validity of someone else without accepting their criminal behavior, if there's a difference between the being of the other person in terms of legitimacy and all that versus actions that they might take, if they're taking a murderous action.
Right.
I think it relates to the idea of boundaries.
Right. Right. No, it's a very good question, and I'm sure we'll take that up tomorrow. I want to take that up in some depth. I think, you know, Dead Men Walking, the sister Prejean, you know, about the guy on death row? You know, she's taking him in just completely, and yet he's done these horrendous deeds. So it is, I think, at the end, at the most challenging point, it's taking in even murderers. Who've done terrible things. I think she's an amazing example of the capacity to do that. We're not, you know, we're giving extreme examples. It's just a really mundane thing. Something that happened to me the other day. I started my office down in Pioneer Square, and I sort of, you know, my patients are mainly middle-class people, and the square, you know, there's homeless people lying around. The other day, I was walking down, and I saw a chicken bone, a half-eaten chicken bone, lying on the square. And I just couldn't take that chicken bone in. It was too yucky. You know, one of my patients sees that chicken bone. So I had to just take in what that chicken bone represented and meant. you know, as a sort of mentally ill homeless person, probably just threw it down there. Who knows what it was? Just little things like that. It's just a very little, small thing. Most of us won't be faced with taking in murderers on death row or fighting fascist dictators or whatever, you know.
Could you just say a little bit about how, on the one hand, Osama bin Laden might be a shadow figure, but then the chicken bone is a shadow figure as well? Because they seem so familiar.
Well, I wanted to get to the mundane. You see, the chicken bone was just a symbol of disorder and garbage and sort of muck and yucky stuff. It was lying around the entrance. What? Yeah, not caring and just, you know, littering and throwing dirty things. It wasn't paper, it was worse. It was decaying food matter on the entrance to my lovely office, you know. And I wasn't going to tolerate that. Well, I'll talk about that tomorrow. I think Osama's our ultimate shadow figure right now. You know, he's saying all these terrible things about our hegemonic meta-narrative. If you listen to his stuff, it's not all crazy. The New Yorker's done another wonderful thing on the various Muslim discourses throughout the last 800-900 years. And sort of worked up to this. Osama says, what happened 80 years ago? And that was the end of the Turkish caliph, you know, when the British and French came rushing in, defeated the Turks and established a secular society in Turkey. And the caliph, who was the sort of leader of the Muslim empire in a certain sense, was deposed. And there's never been a caliph in Turkey again. So he's sort of referring back to that narrative about Muslim history that's really important to them. And the secularization of Turkey was sort of fought massively by the still being fought in Turkey. The whole secularization, which is westernization to the Muslims, is very shadow for them, terribly shadow. So we're an enormous big shadow to them, very destructive
shadow. The shadow is the exclusion of some aspect.
Right.
How is this figure that you're so afraid of, shadow?
Well, we'd have to do that tomorrow with Osama, because we'd have to amplify Osama, what he's meaning to all of us. You know, I can speculate on what he's meaning to the society at large. You know, one of the things is the linking of state and religion. That's a very foreign notion to us. And that's sort of fundamental to fundamentalist Muslims, and a lot of regular Muslims, is linking up religion and the state. That was the thing that was got going in Iran. And that's a very foreign notion. You know, America was created on separation of church and state. Now, all the religious schismatics came over from England and Europe and said no more. But yet they're privileging that idea. That's a very opposite idea. That's just one thing. Go ahead.
A while back you mentioned Hitler, Osama, and Saddam Hussein kind of like the same type of people.
Uh-huh.
And yet I know that, like, in other parts of the world, they would consider a lot of American leaders, you know, to be those type of people, because America has, you know, done some real nasty, you know, things that contributed to mass destruction in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, why wouldn't you refer to that? I mean, it seems like you're being especially evil by, you know, being exclusionary.
What, the United States policies, ideas are exclusion?
Why would you include the Bushes or Reagan?
Oh, sure, sure, sure. Sure, oh, of course. We include ourselves in our exclusionary narratives. We hear it all the time from our politicians. Our politicians aren't doing a great job. Some of our media is doing a pretty good job. We really don't hear much discussion of the complexity of this whole thing. We hear rooting out evil in holes. You know, that sounds like those cosmogony mythology things about purification that I talked about. You know, we don't hear much It's complex dialogue going on.
Yeah, it seems like you use the 911 thing, you know, as a pretty good model. But the country mood change, it was very empowering.
Mm-hmm.
And these people that perpetrated that thing crossed the line, you know.
Right.
And then I feel like I had to choose one side or another. You know,
right.
And I got to this thought that I'm a very tolerant person, but, you know, if anything goes, that seems to be the definition of evil.
Right, right.
In other words, total chaos is just an evil. Any definition of evil?
Well, we're getting into all sorts of really interesting questions, which I hope people will come, at least some of these questions will get raised in the, because this will take me 15, 20 minutes to really get into. There's a really important, deep questions which require careful attention. You know, because 3,000 people were killed in those towers. So taking in that without wanting to take revenge is a very difficult thing to do. Just one more.
I just would like to know, how did you take in that chicken bone?
I don't think I've fully taken it in yet. I'm still struggling with that chicken bone. And every time I go down to the square, I think about it. And it's difficult. It's partly taken in. At least it was observed as a shadow figure for me or a shadow object for me. It's really an experience at this point. It hasn't become fully worked through at this point. It hasn't become metabolized. So, Sharon, I think we better stop.
Yeah, well, Michael, thank you once again. I just want everybody to know that if you want to browse for a